Okay, hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Innovations in Education, eSchool News' podcast, where we explore the innovations shaping education in the digital age. I'm your host, Kevin Hogan, and on this month's episode, we're diving into the evolving world of remote learning strategies. Now, the COVID pandemic thrust schools into emergency remote teaching mode virtually overnight, but now, years later, how have those experiences shaped more intentional approaches to digital education? And what does the future hold as, yep, there's that acronym again, AI, begins to transform what's possible? My conversation with John Watson today features insights from his experiences working with school districts around the country. He shares how schools are moving beyond emergency measures to create purpose-driven online and hybrid programs. In this conversation, we explore how today's remote learning differs from that pandemic-era emergency teaching. We talk about why relationships remain critical in virtual environments. John talks about the surprising ways schools are using digital platforms for everything from dropout recovery to career education. And of course, we touch upon the potential revolutionary impact of AI on educational content. So whether you're a district leader, tech director, or classroom teacher, I think you'll discover how schools are strategically implementing remote options to be something that you might want to think about for your own work. Have a listen. Okay, John, thanks so much for joining me today. It's great to see you, although virtually, remotely, right, as we use these remote learning platforms. And as we mentioned and talked about before we started recording, the last time I saw you, we were in the depths of the pandemic. And now, thankfully, we're kind of on the other end of that. However, you know, we still have the vestiges of it, for better or for worse. And especially when it comes to the ideas of remote learning strategies, maybe we just dive right into things. Talk about the state of play from your perspective when it comes to the idea of remote learning.
What we're seeing in remote learning, digital learning broadly, is we define digital learning as all these instances where students are learning outside of the time and place constraints that you see in a traditional school, in a traditional district. Now, that sometimes takes the form of a fully online school, but that's actually fairly rare. What we're seeing much more commonly is students who are mixing on-site and online learning. Sometimes those are formal hybrid schools, a hybrid school that actually has some days where students are learning from home, other days where students are learning from school. What we're also seeing, though, is a lot of really interesting different use cases that people don't necessarily think of as online or hybrid or digital in any form. So, for instance, when you think about CTE, a lot of CTE is combining online and face-to-face, in part because there's a lot of CTE that you can deliver remotely. But then the other piece is that we see a lot of cases when schools are implementing really impactful, innovative CTE programs that may involve students leaving to go work on a job site or work at a different building. And in order to free up, let's say, when I say a different building, what I mean by that is it might be an innovation center or makerspace or something that the school district has, as well as it might be something out in the community. In order to free up the time for the student to be able to go have that experience that may be during school hours, that student may now be taking a couple of online courses to free up the time in their schedule. Mm-hmm. So there's these two examples of how CTE taps into online learning. Seeing some really interesting early college and middle college schools that are located on community college campuses. I was at one of these, a really great one out in California, just a few weeks ago. These are using online courses as well and a hybrid schedule, and students are taking community college courses. So when they graduate from high school, they're well on their way to an associate's degree. I was chatting with a longtime friend of mine who's working in dropout recovery. So there's a lot of dropout recovery programs that you may be familiar with. And to my knowledge, the examples I'm seeing are hybrid or online. And it makes a ton of sense because it's not like these students who are coming back in are typically going back into a regular mainstream school in a traditional district. So these are hybrid digital programs as well. So you have all these different examples that are out there. Really important to recognize these are all different than the remote emergency learning that happened during the pandemic, which was so recent, although it's hard to believe it was, what, 5 years ago now.
Yeah.
All these schools had to pivot to being remote in incredibly short periods of time. And they did incredibly valuable, heroic work to pull that off. But it was very different. There's no way that you could expect an entirely new instructional model to be implemented in a few days or a weekend or a week. Like we saw a lot of cases where the teachers and school leaders were putting their plans together over a spring break, and then the school, quote unquote, came back, but it came back remotely after a week. You know, these online and hybrid schools will often go through a year of planning and then a year of at a deliberately small number of students in a pilot status. And so instead of a year of planning plus a year of a small size or pilot status, the programs for emergency remote learning were being put together in a weekend or a week.
Yeah. And so, you know, for our readers and for our listeners who went through that, and again, I'd like that distinction between that experience and what you see these tools being implemented now. Is there a strategic difference when district leaders should be thinking about these things? I mean, you talk about dropout recovery, for instance. I mean, it's program first, technology second, right? I mean, it's not.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
These programs aren't there for the sake of the technology. It's the vice versa.
And not only that, I've seen exceedingly few cases where you could really say the technology is driving the program. These programs, in almost all cases, are being driven by what's the need that a school or a student or a family or parents are trying to figure out. What's the problem they're trying to solve? And at a school or district level, it may be trying to offer more course options. It may be trying to bring students back in who have dropped out. It may be from a traditional district perspective, because we see a lot of traditional districts offering their own online or hybrid academies. They're trying to reach students and families who may have left for a different option. Some of those have gone private. Some of those have become homeschool families. But those students and families, even if they like some aspects of, let's use the homeschooling example, they may like some aspects of homeschooling, but they also realize they miss some of the socialization. They miss some of the extracurriculars that they may be able to get in other ways, but they always felt like, hey, a school is a great option for sports and music and theater and all those other clubs and other pieces that they're interested in. And so you see these districts that have some level of an entrepreneurial spirit. And some of them do, not as many, quite honestly, as I would like. And I think there's no question that when you think about what creates a successful school and district leader, that's not necessarily selecting for people who are entrepreneurially minded. And I mean that in a very value-free way. It's just the way it is. If you're climbing up the ranks of school or district leadership, it's probably not because you're taking a lot of risks. There's a lot of reasons that public schools are tending towards the side of being risk averse. And some of that starts with all the regulations that the states and the feds put onto public schools. That's a whole different conversation. But the thing is, what we see is that more and more district leaders are having to be entrepreneurial. They're having to think about, in this time of declining enrollments, how do we bring students and families back, and thinking about innovative ways to do that.
Yeah. Now, there are a lot of products and services focused specifically on the education space, especially kind of like at a district-wide sort of level. On the other hand, there are a lot of kind of traditional vanilla. I mean, we're talking on Zoom right now, right? But then you could go through Microsoft 365 and you could go through Google Classroom. And a lot of these tools are kind of baked into the kind of the everyday tools that we're using already. Do you have recommendations for districts on whether or not they need to go to another level when it comes to, depending on what the program is that they're looking to make remote, or at least offer those sort of remote aspects into that dynamic?
Absolutely. When you think about most of the technology that gets used in a mainstream school in a traditional district, most of the technology is being used in a classroom that doesn't look too different than a classroom looked like when you and I were in school. What that means is that technology use case is very different than the technology use case in an online or hybrid school, in which that remote technology, the need for communications between students and teachers, quite possibly the need for communications and collaborations between students, the much higher level need for sharing of resources and using them in really interactive ways. All these things become mission critical for an online or a hybrid school, because if you're in a mainstream school, traditional district, technology fails one day, what do? Well, you go back to what you were doing prior. If that fails and you're on a remote day in a hybrid school, you got major problems. So you just lost your infrastructure. And so it's a different level. Without naming names specifically, I'll mention there's a product out there that probably every one of your listeners would know. And some people refer to it as a learning management system. But people in our DLAC community would say, no, that's not an LMS, because that is not powerful enough to support real instruction and learning online at a distance. And that's not to say it's a bad product. It's a great product for a certain use case, but it's not the digital learning use case as we define it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I know that you find that relationships are hugely important when it comes to the establishment of remote learning situations. Can you talk a little bit about how to make those relationships work in a remote environment? And specifically, we're talking about the students and the importance of inclusivity in the classrooms. And I know DEI has suddenly become a dirty word somehow, but I always felt in our conversations before that it was a good thing. How are those things applied in a remote setup? Have you seen examples of that working? And if so, what are some of the best practices to kind of establish the culture that all ed tech leaders know is important in person? How do you extrapolate that to the internet?
So first of all, I want to just echo the point that you're making in your question, which is in these online settings, relationships and student engagement are absolutely critical. And I don't want to make it sound like this is a completely solved issue. We have within our digital learning community these conversations all the time with our member schools about, okay, how do you engage students? What does that look like? It actually starts with some pretty simple things. If you're an online school, the experienced online schools make sure they're reaching out to make contact with students, and for younger students, with caregivers, with families from the start. Let me give you a super simple example. Relatively inexperienced school might say, oh yeah, if a student hasn't logged in by 3 or 4 days after the start of the semester, we reach out to them. Experienced school says, oh no, we started the outreach the week before the semester. Like if it's day one and we don't have a sign of engagement, we know we already have a problem, and we don't start collecting the data on day one or day two or day three. We start thinking about what we need to do ahead of time and then doing that outreach to make sure that students and families know that we are there and we're seeking to connect with them. So that's one thing. Second thing, interesting thing that came out of the pandemic, that emergency remote learning that I talked about. In a lot of cases, there were traditional school districts that were having kids on video for hours a day. That wasn't a great approach. The DLAC team works remotely. We don't want to spend hours a day on video, right? We're working in different ways, and online students are doing the same. But having said that, pre-pandemic, online schools were tending to not use very much video. They weren't tending to use all that much synchronous interaction. And synchronous interaction these days does mostly mean video. Now, I think part of that is because when you think about a lot of these online schools, they date back to the earliest ones were in the mid to late 1990s. And then you have a lot of these schools that were starting in the early to mid 2000s. And certainly there have been plenty of others that have started more recently. But some of these more experienced ones started in the days when bandwidth and video technology simply didn't allow for high quality video discussions like you and I are having now. We couldn't do this when online schools were starting. And even after online schools had been around for a little while, we'd be doing this and then you'd be frozen and then I'd be frozen. And wow, that does not work if you got a group of students with a teacher. That's different now. And online schools are recognizing. And so one of the things that we see them building in are more opportunities for synchronous video interaction. That doesn't mean a student and a teacher being online for 4 hours a day, but it does mean regular check-ins. It might mean some tutoring opportunities. It might mean check-ins like we've seen with some younger age students and schools and classrooms. They'll do something that they'll call homeroom. It's like everybody gets online at the same time in the morning for a half hour. And it might be a discussion about, hey, how are you feeling today? What are your plans? We know we've got these different things that we're working on. How are you all thinking about doing those things? So it just creates this sense of community. And it's incredibly powerful, not just having the one-on-one engagement between the student and the teacher or the family and the school, but between students as well and between families. And you create the sense of, yeah, this online school or this hybrid school is a community and we've got each other. And yeah, we might not see each other face to face, but we're going to be able to see each other over video. We're going to be able to chat, sometimes text chat in real time, sometimes being on video, all these pieces and being really creative about the ways that those things work.
Now, talk a little bit about where you see this evolution continuing, right? I mean, we're kind of watching it come from where you say, you know, in making the distinction between that emergency real-time experience that we had to some maybe real solid state sort of models of remote and hybrid that are here to stay. Look into your crystal ball a little bit. I mean, where is this heading? Where are some, if the technologies play out, if the funding plays out, if all things being equal and positive, where do you see some of these strategies and technologies going?
I'm going to give you two answers to this. And answer one is, during the pandemic, a lot of students and families and teachers realized that emergency remote learning wasn't for them. At the same time, even though there wasn't prep time to make it a great experience overall, there were a bunch of students and families and teachers who felt like, oh yeah, I really like this. And that has led to an increase in the number of students in all of these different online and hybrid schools and these digital programs. Pre-pandemic, there was a steady growth. It wasn't explosive, but it was steady growth. And basically what we saw was this jump up during the pandemic and then a drop off after the pandemic, but a settling down at a higher level. So basically, you see this increase pre-pandemic, you see the numbers go up, come down. And if you were to draw a line, it's like line up, step function up, and then the trajectory of increase, of slow, steady increase continues, but now at a significantly higher level. And that significantly higher level really encompasses a lot of these pieces that I mentioned around CTE and dual credit and dropout recovery programs and all these other things. So pre-pandemic, when people used to say things like, oh yeah, there's blended learning all around us. And my response would, you know, in more mainstream schools, and I'd be like, you know, there's a definitional issue there. But to me, that looks a lot like using technology in a traditional classroom. Now we are truly at the point where there's a lot more of these different cases of these digital programs that are transcending barriers of time and space. And part of that is the experience that a lot of people had during the pandemic. Part of it is the pandemic spurred a lot more adoption of computers, laptops, better internet bandwidth, all those pieces that schools and students are now more likely to have. And if you have that embedded, it becomes in a district or in a school, it becomes that much easier to adapt that basic foundational technology to a different type of use case. Again, I'll use CTE as an example. So we see all those things going on. And we see that growth in these different ways. So that's one version of the answer to your question. Here's the other version of an answer to your question. Because of what AI is doing, we have no idea what's coming next.
We got almost 20 minutes in and we hadn't mentioned AI. That was pretty good. That's a world record.
I think there's a, Kevin, you and I have talked over the years. So you may recognize this about me. I have over the years been a technology skeptic in our field. Our field depends on basic foundational levels of technology. But over the years, when people would say things like, oh, VR, it's going to transform education, augmented reality, gamification, on and on. I was like, every one of those cases, like, I'll believe it when I see it. I don't believe it.
Yeah.
This is the first technology that I think is going to do it. And the reason is because I think this technology is going to completely overwhelm society. And I am quite concerned that education is not ready. One of the things that we do with our small DLAC team, we share consistently, like, what's the latest crazy thing you've done with technology, with AI? And I worry that especially within the mainstream schools, those schools don't have the time to do this kind of experimentation. I think the teachers who can do it tend to be outliers. And I also think that when you consider the changes that are going to need to be made to take advantage of AI technologies, they can't happen at an individual classroom level. They have to happen at a school and systems level. And I'm just not seeing it. I see the guidance that comes out, and I know it's well-intended and it's needed, but it's not close to being sufficient.
Yeah.
So since we're doing this as a podcast, are you familiar with the podcasting, quote unquote, podcasting capability of the Google product Notebook LM?
No.
Let me give you an example. I uploaded, we did a recent DLAC report on remote testing. So it's just the idea that students in online schools have to test in a face-to-face environment. It causes all sorts of problems. I uploaded that report into this product called Notebook LM, which is a Google product, because we use Google for our workspace. It's free for, I mean, it's no additional cost, right? In 4 minutes, Notebook LM produced what sounded exactly like a podcast of two people discussing that report. And when I played it for somebody who is highly experienced and knows this field, has been in technology for education technology for decades, but just didn't know this particular thing, to blown away. People are blown away by this. And so this is why I say, like, it's like every few weeks something comes along that's just mind blowing.
You just made me obsolete in 2 minutes. But I understand what you're saying. I mean, it's
you're not obsolete though, because here's what aspect of Notebook LM. Apparently, I haven't played with this tool. You can inject yourself in. So, like, you can interact with the AI to have conversations as well. Uh-huh. Actually, what's happening is I made myself obsolete. You can run podcasts without needing guests.
All we need is our avatars, right?
You know, it's the concept of AGI, artificial general intelligence, and I know that in some circles that term gets bandied around a lot. Others are not as familiar with it. It's just basically the idea that we're somewhere on the order of 2 to 3 years, and I see this from a lot of different sources that I trust, 2 to 3 years from the point where AIs will be indistinguishable from people, except the way they're distinguishable from the average person is these AIs will know everything that's been known to people at all. So it's like, talk to all the smartest people in every field wrapped into one person. That is what's going to be available. And the latest thing that I've really noticed around what I think of as people who have a sense for how impactful this is versus those who don't. And so if there's one thing around AI that I would leave your listeners with, if you're not using the voice functions of AI, you have to use the voice functions, because AI talks back to you and it doesn't sound anything like Siri from not too long ago or any of those other ones. You know, like this podcast through Notebook LM that I'm telling you about, there are the ums and ahs that people like us have. There's what sounds like breathing. You know, it's like,
wow.
I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. I'm aware of some of the schools in our community that are using AI technology to completely rethink how they're developing course content. I'll say one of these is a state-funded program that is absolutely convinced that just about every school district in the country will be able to create all their own content within a very short period of time. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I certainly see the argument. And even if that's not exactly true or exactly true in that time frame, it's certainly going to be transformative for how all sorts of content gets created. And you think about within content creation, you think about the idea that how hard it is for anybody who's creating content across multiple states to think about state standards and things like that. Now it's going to become incredibly easy once you train an AI to do it. But then you think about all the other things. You know, there's been discussion about personalized learning, obviously, for decades now. I think it's truly going to be here. When you think about, you take a U.S. history course, you develop it, the capability, if it doesn't already exist, we're not far from being able to say, okay, now give me a version of that course for an English language learner. Now give me a version of that course for a student who's a little bit behind on their reading skills. Now give me a version of that course for this and that and the other. And it's going to be pretty close to like hit a button and wait for the AI to kick it back to you in a little while.
Yeah. It's amazing stuff and always exciting and maybe a little bit scary at the same time, as this decade has proven out to be. So, John.
Well said.
Thank you so much for your time and your insights. I really appreciate it. And I know our readers and listeners do too. And I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thank you, Kevin. I always appreciate your work and the opportunity to be on with you.
And that's about it for this month's edition of Innovations in Education. Be sure to go up onto eschoolnews.com to check out other episodes, as well as dig into the multitude of resources that eSchool has to help you properly integrate technology into the day-to-day workings of your classrooms. I'm Kevin Hogan, and thanks for listening.